Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. Happy New Year. How is your year starting out so far? For once, I actually feel somewhat rested after the holidays. Doing nothing is not something I'm terribly good at anymore with my parental responsibilities and goings on of my kids, my career, my hobbies and tinkerings, but somehow, maybe it's just because of the way the holidays fell this year on a Monday and Tuesday and gave me a couple of extra long weekends. But whatever the case, I was able to do a fair amount of lounging and exercise, read, and even sneak in a few naps. I should mention, actually, a couple of the books that I read here that I liked. One is by Pico Iyer, who is friends with the Dalai Lama and the late Leonard Cohen. Really great little book called The Art of Stillness. It's only about 100 pages long, produced in collaboration with TED Books. It's a very timely bit of writing, though, about how to stay connected with a present mind state, even when it is, now that it's more important than ever, I think, with the way screens have come to dominate our existence and take us out of our internal presence at every turn. But it's not just it's not a book about meditation. It's in the formal sense, though it could translate into your meditation practice, but it's more broadly about what happens when we are still. It's a great new year, fresh start kind of read. Another one is Matthew Walker's Why We Sleep book. About 30 years of research that he's done as a sleep diplomat, as he calls himself, making the case that sleep is most likely the single most important thing we can do for our health. And it's a surprisingly entertaining book because of all the studies trying to prove or debunk all the things that aid in sleep and what our sleep target should be based on a lot of evidence. I heard him last summer. One of my friends sent me the podcast he did with Joe Rogan. And I've been slowly putting some of those concepts to work for me, and I wanted to kind of go through it in the book form. And maybe that's why I was able to chill a little easier during my downtime. Who knows? The other book that I dug into was a fun one, the Beastie Boys book. It's about 500 pages long, and though half of it is pictures and bits of song lyrics, even recipes and memorabilia, just realizing there's another connection here to the Dalai Lama through this book, through MCA, the late great Adam Yauch of the Beastie Boys, who was the force behind the Tibetan Freedom Concerts. But the book serves as both a history of their musical collaboration and artistic journey, while giving a glimpse into the music scene of in New York in the early 80s and the transition from punk to rap and hip hop, and just the melting pot of nearly every music genre that they sampled in their music. And some unbelievable happenstances that occurred with them and the collaborations that they had with so many different artists and making, you know, the art form that became a huge part of our culture. If you're a fan at all, I'm sure you'll find this quite entertaining. If this is the first time you're tuning into this podcast, this is not just a show about health, but improving our experience, and, you know, which is what I think most people are working towards in their own health pursuits. My guests are solution seekers, people looking to improve our experience here together on the planet. They are people I believe have insights and practical applications. They're people whose intention it is to help us find our own truth and simple answers to matters that are oftentimes made to seem complicated. Today's guest is no exception. My conversation today is with director Abby Epstein, who collaborated again with executive producer Ricky Lake, following up their 2008 Business of Being Born documentary for a new film called Weed the People. But before we get to that, just a quick reminder that Highway to Health is now on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Buzzsprout, and Stitcher. So wherever you're, whether you're on a subway or a bus, in your car, at your desk, or walking down the sidewalk, there's always an easy way to hear us. Also, if you haven't taken the time yet, please consider giving us a rating. It really helps to increase our visibility. And if you feel like you have something nice to say, you can also review us and give people who might be scrolling through an idea of which episode they should click on if they want to check us out. Thank you in advance for that. One more thing, would you consider showing support for the podcast and keep it ad-free by donating to our Patreon? You can go to patreon.com/highwaytohealth, and you can show your support for as little as $1 a month. And if you want to learn more about our mission with this podcast and its community, check out our video on the Patreon page. So today I get to talk to Abby Epstein about what she and Ricky Lake's latest film, Weed the People, is about, coming out here January 22nd. It's far from a stoner film. It is about cannabis, but how it could be used in the treatment of cancer and with incredible results. The film follows six families who have exhausted traditional forms of cancer treatment and turned to cannabis as a Hail Mary, and the results totally blew my mind. It's also a conversation about cancer research and why Schedule I status is limiting not only research, but life-saving treatment. We start out here talking about the origins of Abby and Ricky's film collaboration. Please enjoy my conversation with Abby Epstein. How did you and Ricky meet?
The Vagina Monologues.
Ah.
Yeah. When we did the show here off Broadway, we had, in the beginning, we had like a rotating cast of three actresses that would rotate every 2 weeks.
Okay.
So it's kind of like three, you know, celebrity or high profile actresses. And so she was in my cast.
Oh,
one of my casts. Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool. And so how did you guys know that you had a thing that you wanted to do something with?
We didn't. I mean, we just became friends.
Yeah.
And I think at that time I was still just very much doing the theater. She was still living in New York. We became friends. And then...
So this is why, while she was doing the show? Or was she acting more?
She was, at that time, I feel like the Ricky Lake show was maybe almost over.
Okay.
So we met like 2 years before 9/11. And then she left New York right after 9/11. And then she moved out to LA, and we kind of lost touch for a minute. And then one day I was in LA, and I just came by to like say hi and see her new house and her new life. And then we were, oh, and sorry. And by then, I'm sorry. So then I had made my first documentary in that time. So I had done a documentary that grew out of the Vagina Monologues.
Yeah, yeah, I saw that.
So then I saw her in LA, and she was just like going on about this birth project she wanted to do. And she was like, I don't know what it is. Like, I don't know if it's a book or it's like a movie or, you know, I just really... And I was like, well, I just did a movie. I don't know. So it was just one of those like kind of... You know, I was a little like skeptical, like, I don't know what this kind of movie would be like, you know. And then she gave me some books to read and was sort of like, oh, you have to read this book and this book. And I'm so fascinated by all this childbirth stuff. And so then, yeah, that's when the movie started taking shape.
And was it because of her birthing?
Oh, yeah,
experience?
Yeah. Like, I hadn't even been pregnant.
Yeah.
I hadn't even like been pregnant with either of my kids.
And yet you still decided to have children after doing...
I got pregnant during the movie.
Did you really?
Yeah, I got pregnant during the making of the movie. Yeah, I know.
I think I told you, I'd started working with babies like maybe 2 years prior.
Mm-hmm.
And my 15-year-old is actually not my biological son, he's my stepson, but mm-hmm. we've been together since he was five. So it was like right around that time my wife and I were... starting to think about having a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And then we watched the documentary right around the time. But I'd been seeing all these things with babies too, that I was like sort of questioning whether like what was Pitocin's sort of effect on babies and digestion, because mm-hmm. I was seeing these things over and over again. And I worked mm-hmm. with a lot of lactation consultants.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like one of the few guys in the lactation world. I'm kind of a craniosacral / lactation specialist,
okay.
even though I don't have any of the certifications, but I've just been around it for so long that, you know, I know when there's a feeding challenge right away.
Yeah.
So, but there was some shocking stuff in that I think I was like, okay, this is what I'm going into.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. No, that movie, it's fascinating because it's just like, it's just never ends. I mean, it's like we were, even like now that Ricky and I go to all these cannabis conferences and like all the women come up to us and they're like, well, first I have to tell you that the business of being born changed my life.
Yeah.
No, they're like, you don't understand. It changed my life. And that happens to us constantly, you know? So it's funny because to us, it's like, oh, the movie's 10 years old, but,
right.
you know, there's still really nothing out there that's comes close to that movie no. in terms of preparing you for, you know, the system. So it's still like just, you know, like for all these couples, it's like brand new for them, you know. But it was funny. I was talking to one guy the other day, and I was like, oh, so you have a four-year-old? You live in Brooklyn, and you didn't see The Business of Being Born? I don't understand. And he was like, honestly, he goes, I felt like it had basically, like, permeated the zeitgeist to the point where, like, I didn't even need to see it because we were already going that route, you know?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
funny.
I mean, so you had no idea that, you've tracked into so many different health-related things.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like they're all on some level, like, empowerment, like related or related to women's sexuality or reproductive justice, or just really like empowerment around, like, you know, female sexuality or generally just female
just
health,
female experience.
Yeah,
too.
And exactly. And so I think that it's funny because it's like I don't really have any interest in like health in a medical sense, you know, like don't really, you know, I don't really care about like taking down big pharma or, you know, that's like one of my goals. But it just ends up like dovetailing.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of what happened with me starting the podcast mm-hmm. was that I was becoming more interested in the belief systems we have culturally and around how we stay well and what causes these belief systems to develop in the first place. Because I think that it has a huge effect on our communities as a whole. And I was becoming more drawn to that conversation than I was about healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this in your work in the film here, too. I'm sure spending this much time with the subject over the course of making the film.
Yeah.
Because you followed these families for a number of years. Did you find your personal beliefs around the use of cannabis change during this project?
Yeah. I mean, I think that when we made Weed the People, I mean, it took like 6 years to make from beginning to end. And I think in those 6 years, it's... you know, kind of unbelievable
so
how
much
the
has
entire
too.
Cannabis industry has just emerged and things have changed so much. So I don't, you know, I still think they're changing. Like I was at a conference this week and one of the scientists I was talking to was like, oh, you know, in cannabis science, it's like dog years, you know, it's like every year, 7 years, because it's like it just is moving that fast, you know?
What do you think the forces are on it?
You know, I think that there's always been like pure kind of academic interest in cannabinoids, you know, mm-hmm. going back to the 60s. And it's been relatively easy to study in some countries, not in the United States. But so I think there's always been kind of pure interest. And some of these scientists, as we show in the film, are sort of like accidental, like discovering like, you know, these cancer-killing properties and other properties of these compounds in the plant. I think that, you know, all like research, I won't say all research, but a lot of the research around cannabis and most plants is really fueled by drug development, right? And the billions of dollars waiting at the end of the rainbow when you patent some drug or you come up with the next, you know, super drug. So I think that back then, you know, I think when I talked to like the Israeli scientists or whatever, they were very frustrated because they we're seeing all this incredible clinical research and in the animal model too, amazing, you know, with CBD as an antioxidant and everything from diabetes, it was, you know, they were seeing to rheumatoid arthritis, to cancer, to traumatic brain injuries. Mm-hmm. You know, they were really seeing like incredible preclinical evidence and they couldn't really get anything funded. Couldn't really get anything moving forward, whether it was because drug companies were kind of skittish about doing anything that had to do with the cannabis plant
mm-hmm.
or because, you know, but now I would say that the endocannabinoid system is slightly more established as like a real system than now they are looking at more, you know, drug pathways and more drugs that act on these receptors. So I think it's crazy. It's like, you know, one minute I meet a cannabis researcher, professor, scientist at a conference, and a year later I hear that, you know, some huge cannabis company has just given him $500 million and basically said, just go, and whatever you discover, we own.
Okay.
You know, and so that's driving a lot of this. I mean, look, I think that what we show in the film is that there are these kind of more mom and pop practitioners and companies that are working with the plant, that are making medical preparations, that are just, you know, really believe in whole plant medicine. And that's one avenue that it's important, you know, to keep that access, to sort of keep the plant as a botanical that's accessible,
right,
and customizable. But I don't see...
That could be problematic if they turn it into just a pharmaceutical.
Well, that's kind of, I think, what I see happening. It's just becoming so overregulated that none of those people really can stay in business. And I feel like they are sort of paving the way for the cigarette companies. I don't know if you saw, like Altria just made one of the biggest investments in Canadian cannabis industry.
No, I didn't see it.
Yeah, like huge. You know, so I feel like they're paving the way for the cigarette companies, for example, as cigarette smoking's declining.
Yeah.
They're kind of paving the way for them to take over this cannabis industry. Even the beer and alcohol companies are getting involved, you know, because they probably see their sales.
They see the dollar signs.
And also pharmaceuticals. I mean, I think they, you know, look, I think biologists do say that, hey, the future is in these derivatives, you know, it's coming up with the derivatives of the plant. And you know, like if you take penicillin, right, you're not taking penicillin anymore. Penicillin doesn't exist. It's a derivative. You know, everything, they're all derivatives. And I think they kind of don't buy this whole thing that, oh, it has to be from the whole plant so you can get this whole like spectrum of like, you know, terpenes and cannabinoids. You know, they're like, yeah, okay, that's okay to believe, but like we really believe it's about these derivatives because that's how we know how to build pharmaceuticals.
Well, even think about it in relation to like apples. Like that's a genetically modified, you know, food.
Yes.
And the whole apple a day thing for a long time was like something that was that people totally bought fully into.
Yeah.
And yet we're continuously modifying that fruit.
Yeah.
And it's the same kind of thing with a plant. I mean, that's the one thing. And I think we're still dealing with so much stigma around this. I mean,
yeah.
I was just telling people that I was going to have a conversation about this topic. And also the fact that, you know, we're talking about it in relation to pediatric medicine.
Yeah.
That's so shocking to some people. And yet, I know people who have had children who have had to be treated this way.
Yeah.
You know? And is it Aunt Zelda? Is that the name of the woman that's in the movie?
Yeah, you know, Mara Gordon from Aunt Zelda. Yeah.
You know, her name's what? Mara Gordon?
Mm-hmm.
That you have to, I mean, in some ways it's nice that you have somebody who's so reliable and is you know, really being so careful and cautious about the way that they're producing things.
Yeah.
And, you know, you show in the documentary the way that, you know, some people are getting some of these things from, you know, people that they hear about or, you know, someone on the street. And that's the downside of, you know, not legalizing it. But I almost kind of wonder, you know, in relation, let's say, to something that's going on with vaccinations or something, like quality control isn't always, you know, provable even at the pharmaceutical level.
Of course.
So right. it's always going to be, you know, brand in some ways. Like, you know, people's reputations are going to be built around these kinds of things. So, you know, Aunt Zelda could be the thing that you know, the standard for things.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to the patent thing, because I still don't quite understand.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain a little bit? It's like it's got a number. It's a patent 6630507.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's the federal government has a federal patent on cannabidiol, which is known as CBD, as an antioxidant and a neuroprotectant. And the patent, if you read it, it's actually got a lot of great information in it. It's very well researched. Mm-hmm. It has dosing, you know. And
it was created when? What year?
It was...
So like early 2000s or something?
2003, I think, right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, I think it was 2003, the patent. Yeah, I mean, so most people don't know that. But it's sort of like, you know, one of the points I think is made in the film by Sanjay Gupta. We have a clip from him, you know, on his show, and he says, well, how can the government on the one hand say this is a Schedule One narcotic,
it's
federally illegal because it has no medical value, and then on the other hand, the same government is saying, oh, wait, but it has such medicinal value that we're going to patent it. You know, it's a complete game. You know, the history of cannabis, which we, you know, briefly outline in the film, we don't go into all the depths and nuances of it, but if you look at the history of cannabis prohibition starting in the 1930s, and you follow the trail, you'll see it's just money. It's just money, racism, and greed. Mm-hmm. There was never anything proven by doctors, by scientists, by anybody to say that this plant is toxic, dangerous, deadly, addictive, you know, all the things that they claim it to be and claim it to have no medical value. It was all completely trumped up.
And the same of the hallucinogenics. I heard mm-hmm. Michael Pollan talking about this on a podcast.
Yes.
You know, that there's just not much evidence of you know, the even with chronic use of any harm. So
it's true. But even I feel like some of those plants or, you know, some of those substances have broken through. It's like the FDA approved MDMA for therapy. You know, what?
I know, and not cannabis.
Right, you know, and it's just like, and all these poor, you know, veterans with PTSD are going to the VA and getting strung out on these medications and developing horrible addictions when, like, really all they want to do is use cannabis. I mean, that's really mm-hmm. what helps veterans with their PTSD, or many of them, that's what they report, and they have to fight for the right, you know, to get that medication, which they can't get from the VA, obviously. You know, it's actually quite cruel. And I think one of the reasons in the film we focus on children is that we wanted to really show how ridiculous this stigma is.
Yeah, I was wondering about if the children focus was part of that.
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, I think the cancer stories were just very compelling.
Yeah.
But then we just decided to focus on children because, yeah, it's controversial, but it's also like, you know, you can't look at these little 9-month-old baby and be like, oh, well, she just likes to get high. You know, this isn't really medicine.
Yeah, yeah.
So it just kind of takes that argument away.
It's more compelling. And you know, you showed the effects of, you know, the, like, we're talking about this, like, these choices between chemotherapy or some harder mm-hmm. drugs in this process mm-hmm. and cannabis. And you see these little kids that, you know, they clearly get like a little high, a little buzz for mm-hmm. a short period of time, but the side effects are nothing.
Right.
Physiologically, compared to what their body can process it so much easier than they can any other drugs.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And they're non-toxic. They can't overdose. It's, you know, and also, I think in many cases in the film, you can see, like, they weren't getting any of their options.
Yeah,
like,
right.
These weren't parents who were just like, oh, yeah, we don't believe in that chemotherapy. These were parents that had done everything the doctors had told them to do, had mm-hmm. done all the chemotherapy, and were left at a point where their children had no options left. So this was sort of like that Hail Mary. You know, in a couple of the stories, it was like a Hail Mary that, you know, worked for some and didn't work for all the kids. But I think the point in the film is just to humanize this controversy, because I think that most people don't really know what medical cannabis looks like. And they sort of picture, you know, somebody with chemotherapy. They're undergoing chemotherapy, losing their hair, like smoking a joint, you know, to kind of like ease the side effects.
Right, the nausea.
Right? It's just a palliative. People don't understand that there's actually like cancer-killing properties within the plant itself. So it's way more than palliative, potentially, you know, if we do the research.
And I think the thing that people will be shocked at seeing it is the rapid decline of these tumors in these kids, and that I felt a little bit for these doctors too, who are kind of stuck in the middle. I mean, I think doctors also get a bad rap in this, in that maybe they're sort of in cahoots with pharmaceutical companies or something. But, like you said in the film, they've been practicing the same methodology mm-hmm. for treating kids with cancer for, 50 years or something? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's varied very little in that time mm-hmm. period. And it's clear that we need to be adding to this. And I've been brought in some pediatric situations, too, with kids who have had some kind of anoxic period through birth or mm-hmm. something, and they know that there's something going on, but even, people in hospitals have told me that we treat babies the same way that we did, 50 years ago, because they don't really allow too many other options. Like, I've had hospitals who kind of want to get me involved in doing craniosacral work, and everybody on staff, from NICU to lactation mm-hmm. always thinks, oh, it'd be great to have you here, but they can't figure out any way to get me into that process. So
yeah, I totally see that. It's the same thing here. And I think that for us, too, we were blocked from filming at many hospitals. We would go maybe film the kids once or twice, and then the hospital would sort of catch wind that there was some cannabis angle, and they would freak out. And I remember appealing to Kaiser, that's one of the biggest hospital chains in California, and appealing to them. And I was like, look, I don't understand why you wouldn't want these films shot, because your oncologists are totally on board. Uh-huh. Not only are they on board, they're blown away by what they're seeing. And on top of that, these kids are doing amazing. Yeah. So you're just going to look like heroes.
Yeah.
But you see, it's this federally illegal thing
that
ruins everything, right? Because why are they going to risk federal funds, or it's just, that's the whole problem. It's too much risk. Same thing with doctors. It's well, you're gonna prescribe a Schedule I drug. It's hard to sort of wrap your brain around that you could lose your license because this is not federally legal. We still have this stupid tension between the state legality and the federal legality, which is just not going to be tenable much longer, especially with Canada going full legal. What are we going to go buy our medicine from Canada? It's ridiculous. Right. So it's got to change soon. But I think we're just in kind of this temporary holding pattern. But I also felt bad for the doctors in the movie, because a lot of them really wanted to speak to us on camera and comment on how well the kids were doing mm-hmm. and how they'd never seen this before. And the hospital's just like, no, 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 no. Finally, at one point, I think it was at Kaiser, one of the hospitals, I said, look, what if I give you all the questions I'm going to ask the doctor? It's going to be 5 questions. It's going to have nothing to do with cannabis. I'm literally just going to say, how is this child doing? What's her prognosis? How is she doing compared to other children who've had the same treatments? That's it.
Yeah.
Not even gonna, no. They would not give us any access to some of the oncologists.
Yes, and that's what I felt too, is the doctors were just in the middle of this. Mm-hmm. And really, it's, if we're gonna deal with bias, just the stigma, I think, around mm-hmm. cannabis, that they are going to lead the charge in this.
Yeah.
So if they're quieted in the process, it's just not going to happen.
No. Yeah, I totally, totally agree.
What was the biggest challenge making this movie?
I think it was just so challenging to try to keep up with all these different families and have cameras there for the scan day or this day, or, just trying to keep up, and then just emotionally, obviously very hard to get involved with these families, with these very sick children. And of course, we would get close to them, and then you mm-hmm. don't know who's going to make it, who's not going to make it. It's terrifying. Cause you're just in it with them. That to me was wondrous. I mean, I just don't know how, being in the hospital sometimes with the moms, and just especially when the kids were not doing well, it's I was just oh my God, how's she doing this?
Yeah.
How's she standing here talking to us? Oh my God. You know what I mean? You can't believe these, I'm saying moms because obviously the dads were very present and supportive, but the moms in the film are kind of the lead characters. Yeah. But you just can't believe, like, not only just how strong they are and, you know, how they can, how proactive they are, like just how they just leave no stone unturned to figure out what's best for their kid or going to save their kid. I mean, it's really like amazing to be around them, but also just, you know, terrifying because you're just like, oh my God, you know, this could be me. This could be me. How would I ever get through this? You know?
Yeah,
it's tough, but I do think that the nice thing about the movie is that I think all around it's like the movie is safe in the sense that it's hopeful.
I felt the same way.
It's very hopeful. We're not going to sit and like torture you of like watching children be sick and tortured in scene after scene. You know, there's really none of that.
Yeah.
We're really looking at their struggle, you know, in the piece of this kind of like bigger controversy, but it's, you know, it's not the kind of movie that's, like just, you know, we're not showing like horrible surgeries and procedures and suffering. Like it's not that movie at all, you know, but it's very hopeful for the most part.
Yeah. And when you start out, you don't know. And my wife gets very sort of, she's challenged by anytime there's something with a child in a movie.
Yeah,
and
most people are.
You know, and I'm sure you showed this at South by Southwest.
We opened at South by Southwest. Yeah.
What was the reception there?
Oh, it was amazing. It was actually incredible. And after that, I think we went to Nashville. We got the audience award in Nashville, and we showed it in Oklahoma City, which is really interesting. It was like 2 weeks before their referendum where they voted in medical cannabis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so we were invited to show it for Parliament in the UK. So I was in London this summer showing it for Parliament because, again, they had a story of one child that went viral. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden the government was like, we have to pass some legislation. We can't just give medicine to one child.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've really screened this for like very, very diverse audiences. And I would say the audience, it's funny because the person who sees the title, you know, Weed the People and thinks it's like a stoner movie, right. And, you know, they're going to be sorely disappointed.
but you almost need to grab a larger audience because there are people who, you know, if they knew that it was just about children, might think, oh, this is just a movie about kids. And but I think there's more going on here too. That's it's such a complicated. I mean, that's the one thing I'm still kind of, you know, stuck with is what's the right answer? You know, how do you move forward? And and isn't there just some way to kind of start this process, even with like one piece? Do you know anything about anything that's changing at this point, in any sort of small ways that you've seen since you started the film?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think a lot is changing. I mean, look, first of all, I think for anything to change, you need a consciousness shift because you can build as many dispensaries as you want and no one's going to go to them. They don't want to be seen in them. Or like in California, you can have cannabis legal everywhere, but you can't open a dispensary anywhere because no one wants them in their town. So it's kind of like you have to kind of get the backing of the people. And that was really the point of this movie. You know, this movie was really to be kind of an inconvenient truth for medical cannabis. And it's not about legalization. It's not about recreational adult use marijuana at all, you know. So I think, yes, I think the consciousness is shifting. I think even the cannabis conference that I was at 2 days ago in Vancouver, you know, the scientists were like, oh my God, like even 2 years ago, the crowd is totally different. I mean, it's totally different because now it's like when you walked around the expo center at this conference, I mean, none of the exhibits had anything to do with the actual plant. It's all agricultural infrastructure, you know, everybody's just doing infrastructure and,
which says that it's probably it's already starting to happen at that level.
100%. You know, I mean, I think that the question is really, will the medical get lost in the recreational? Because I think that you're going to end up eventually with, you know, probably medical in every state, but then mm-hmm. probably adult use in also most states, yeah. you know? So, and I think that's the fear, is it's like this people perceive this, you know, green rush of like the recreational customer, you know?
Right.
And, okay, sure. But you know what I mean? I'm saying like, the recreational customer who's going to buy cannabis products the same way you would go to a liquor store to buy a bottle of scotch or whatever you want to unwind with or right. celebrate with or help you, you know, chill out at night or whatever. It's like, okay, that's just, to me, it's a totally different world yeah. than this medicinal world, you yeah. know? So that's what I'm a little more worried about.
I thought about that too, but I was also sort of wondering, like, just thinking about, say, my 20-year-old self, you know, like, if I knew what I know now,
yeah.
if I was to think about what I, you know, when I was a musician when I was younger, so it was around all the time.
Yeah.
You know, if you had a choice of, you know, actually knowing the kind of strains, what their medicinal properties right. were, how you might actually use it, which right. a lot of younger people actually know at this point.
Yeah.
Would the abuse be the same? You know, and we're talking about something that compared to alcohol mm-hmm. is nowhere near as harmful to the population.
Right.
You know, right. especially if they're not just smoking whatever their friend right. has and in right. whatever dirty
right.
vestibule they're going to use, you know? I mean, yeah. that's the one thing. I've been having these conversations with my 15-year-old lately yeah. because he came in one day and asked Mom, did you smoke weed in high school? Because he's starting to see use happening in high school. Mm-hmm. And vaping is, you know, the delivery method now.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've tried to give him a little bit more of a scientific view on how mm-hmm. it affects you, not demonize it, mm-hmm. you know, because I think it's very easy to, I mm-hmm. think the way it used to be dealt with was kind of black or white, like mm-hmm. something's either good or bad for you. And, but at the teenage level, when the brain is in development, I think it's one of those things that to start a habit at that point in your life mm-hmm. can be problematic because it can be something that you fall back on all the time, and it is going to, you know, affect you. Whereas, you know, when you're older, you know, and I heard Michael Pollan even talking about this with hallucinogenics, that he was saying that they're probably wasted on the youth. That, you know, the thing about this is as we get older, maybe there are ways in which it's better to sort of break our, you know, bad neurological patterns using something like this that's yes. fairly, you know, non-toxic. So
yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that because I think, like, for me personally, like, drugs didn't agree with my younger brain whatsoever, yeah. you know? And it's only recently through really understanding cannabis that I've been yeah. able to use it at all
yeah.
with like good effect, right. you know?
Exactly. That's the way I feel too.
Yeah. I totally agree with that. And I also think too, in terms of like with children and, you know, it's a little bit like, you know, sexuality with teenagers too. Right. So mm-hmm. it's like, if you're going to tell your 17-year-old, you know, oh no, you're not allowed, you know, to have, I mean, that's probably not going to work, right. like trying to insist on abstinence, where it's like, you know, whatever people think of this, but you know, I have friends who live in legal states and they're, you know, fully by their 16 and 17 year olds, legal marijuana, and they prefer to buy it for them. They, you know, they prefer to know mm-hmm. where it comes from
yeah, yeah.
and that it's, you know, good, or it's not like some crazy dabbing or wax or whatever these right. kids do, you know. And also they're very open about it in the sense that they know when their kids are smoking, mm-hmm. you know, and they're very open, like, oh, are you stoned right now? You know what I mean? They know that it's for like the weekend, or they know that they're not like driving. It just, it feels a little more like honest and yeah. open, because yeah. you know that a 17-year-old potentially is going to be trying that out anyway with friends, yeah. like the same, you know. And it's just, I think, better to, I don't know, that would be my opinion. Like, I, you know, I don't think it's endorsing it. I just think it's inevitable. And yeah. like you're saying, the more that we make it And for kids also, it's not as interesting for them to be like breaking rules when your mom's like buying you the pot.
It's
and it's
true.
Like, you
it's
know,
true.
It's kind of like you're like the, you know, why Facebook will eventually go away because no one wants to be on, you know, or it already has gone away for kids, you know, no kids use Facebook.
Yeah. It's just, as my son says, it's Facebook's for old people.
It is. It is.
But yeah, I mean, there's an aspect of that, that the sort of like your, you know, whatever your, the term you use, like the sort of the fear of the green rush.
Mm-hmm.
It's never going to be something that's acceptable to do in the workplace, you know?
Oh no, there's so much stigma.
Yeah.
There really is so much stigma. And, it's funny because I was like, what was I looking at the other day? I was looking at, my friend was showing me one of her like dating apps.
Yeah.
So I was looking at the dating app and I was looking at what all the men put, and every single person, it was saying like, you know, smoke, drink, marijuana or drugs. Right. And every single person put like drink sometimes, and every single person had no for marijuana. Like every single person, every single guy she was showing me on the app. And I was laughing both her, 'cause I was like, it's not possible.
Right.
Like,
I know.
It's just not possible that, you know, none of these, you know, 50 men ever don't, you know, hit a vape pen. But it's like, it's not socially acceptable.
Yeah.
Like, it was funny to me because I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, they think they're going to be judged by being, you know, kind of a casual user. And it's so interesting,
right? And yet CBD, like... You know, my mom's talking to me about it. I went to give my haircut, and my hairstylist has a friend from California who's created this product line with CBD lotion. And they've got it, they're selling it in the salon now. Somebody came in yesterday to see me for an appointment. She's got sort of chronic pain issues and a lot of problems with her feet. And she asked me, she brought in a little thing of CBD cream and asked me if I'd put it on her feet. You know, like that is that's acceptable now.
And CBD, we talk about in the movie, and it's a very important piece of like the cancer killing for sure, along with the THC.
Right.
But my issue with CBD is that, you know, getting these states to pass these CBD only laws is really so missing the point.
Yeah.
And to say like, oh, well, the epileptic kids need it. Well, what about the kids with cancer? They need THC.
Right.
You know, so it's like the CBD stuff kind of pisses me off because it makes THC like the evil stepchild.
Right.
And then it's like, well, as long as you're just using CBD. And like, I've talked to like really knowledgeable like wellness writers and websites, and, you know, we've talked about the movie and they're like, oh, well, we're not really interested in anything that has to do with THC. You know, we only talk about CBD here. And it's like, but you do understand, right? That it's like, even if you're using a CBD product, you want trace amounts of THC in there.
Yeah.
Because nobody really knows how the cannabinoids work best.
And like you were saying in the film, there's something like 4,500... like properties to the plant or some crazy number. I can't remember what it was.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that was the number of strains.
The number of strains.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think they've identified, I think I just heard at the conference, like 350 different actual like cannabinoids in the plant.
Okay.
And
so we're really just talking about these two pieces.
Right. And the funny thing, and now is like the last thing that I've been talking to is is it THCG? I think it's THCG that's super, super hot right now. So, like, people have heard of THC and CBD, okay? But then there's CBDA, there's CBDN. I think it's this THCG. I mean, there's, like, a new thing, you know what I mean? And then what happens is people start discovering THCG. Oh, this can really help people lose a lot of weight. And then all of a sudden there's a shortage of it. No one can get it.
Yeah.
You know, it was like with CBD came out. Initially, there was huge shortages when we were making the movie, and none of the kids could even get it because the growers weren't growing it. And then all of a sudden it was in demand. So you had to like grow it, you know?
Oh, wow.
So now it's like, exactly. Like, I think this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
Now we're going to hear about these other cannabinoids that all have magical powers. And you're just going to have to be really careful about what you read because, you know, I find it very, very sad. Like, look, there's nothing wrong with going to buy a botanical that helps you. And, you know, there's a place that sells a lot of CBD in New York. And they're like, look, the one thing we claim is that we cannot tell anybody that this is clinically going to approve to help anything.
Yeah.
But we will tell you that we have like a super high repeat customer. So it's doing something for these people, you know, or it's placebo effect. Who cares? But doing something for them. Yeah. But, you know, I do feel bad sometimes when I hear someone like saying like, oh, my son is autistic and, you know, they go down to the store and spend $200 on a little bottle of CBD oil and it comes from hemp and it's probably not going to help their autistic kid. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean about not having the education and the support, you know, around medical and, you know, not, and I mean, we need to open it up to more conditions, you know, than just the select few, whatever they pick, you know, that gets you a card or gets you a letter. But I think, you know, that I feel badly because I think you're in a position with this CBD stuff to really exploit people, and they're putting it in coffee and they're putting it in cocktails and, you know, charging a lot of money, which I guess you could say the same about any sort of herbal. But I do think it's it bothers me a little, like the CBD is good and the THC is evil.
Well, it's interesting. It's good. I mean, I think it's important that you're putting out this kind of stuff to give more information.
Yeah.
And that it's going to force people to kind of want to know more for themselves. And one of the things that came to me, like at the end, and actually my wife said the same thing that I was thinking at the same time, was, well, if these kids are, once they're tumor free, let's say, or they're not identifying any cancers with them, should they keep taking it as a preventative?
Right. Yes.
You know, and so it becomes one of those things where, you know, is the right, you know, strain and combination, once you find it, given your genetic code, should you be actually, you know, taking small trace amounts of this to help prevent things in the future? Like, does this go along with other preventative medicine?
Oh, yes, 100%. I think all the experts would agree. And all the kids in the movie who are doing well are all on a maintenance dose. Mm. Absolutely. You know, but you find things out, like sometimes they find with some of these kids, like there's something that you have to do when you're taking, let's say, a high CBD, where you have to take breaks for 2 or 3 days to like clean out the receptors. Yeah. Otherwise it stops working. You know what I mean? There's all these like little tricks of the trade that people are developing. But yes, and I would say they've definitely, as far as cannabis oil being a neuroprotectant, you know, I would say that like a lot of people think like anybody over 65 should be having like a puff a day to protect their brain from dementia and Alzheimer's. You know, I mean,
with what we know or not.
Whether this is true clinically, we don't know. Yeah. But, you know, we know what we see in the model. So it's like, you know, it's when you find, I think, when things work, like I was laughing really hard because I was on a plane coming back from London after we screened the film for Parliament. And there was this couple on my flight and they were so cute. And they were like in their 80s and they lived in Queens and they were like coming back from like celebrating their like 70th wedding anniversary or something crazy. They were so cute. And the woman, she's like, we were chatting on the plane and all of a sudden I looked down at her neck and I was like, Rita, is that a cannabis leaf on your neck? She had like a gold cannabis leaf hanging on her neck. We were like this little Jewish couple from Queens. And she was like, oh yeah. And I was like, what is that? And she was like, oh my God. She goes, I've been using this for my migraines for 45 years.
Oh my God.
And I was like, really? And she goes, yep. She was like, I just have one little puff right if the migraine's coming on, takes care of the nausea, takes care. I mean, it was like, this was her thing. Like she found this 45 years ago. 45 years ago, she's been doing this. You know what I mean? And how did she hear about it? Or somebody must have figured this out, or she found it out accidentally, right?
Right.
But it was so cute. And I was like, that's amazing. And she was like, yep, it's the best thing. And then, you know, I said, oh, now you know, you can actually go like buy it at dispensary. They have dispensary in Queens. And she was like, oh, no, no, I just go to the bodega. You know, like she has her like bodega, her guy. She's still buying it on the black market because that's the thing. Like it's, you know, the interesting thing about cannabis is like when it works, it works. And so a lot of the science and the research is happening backwards, right? Because it works so well and it's so safe. People are just like using it first and now they're doing the science to try to figure out like why this works on so many different conditions. Yeah.
Where are you at right now with the movie in terms of like hitting popular market?
So we're almost there. We're getting there. We're doing our digital release on January 22nd.
Okay. Oh, no, yeah. That's awesome.
So January 22nd, it'll be available on iTunes. And then I think, yeah. And then 2 weeks later, I think it'll be available on like a bunch of platforms for downloading, streaming, all that stuff. And then much later on, it'll end up on Netflix as everything tends to.
Yeah, yeah.
All good documentaries
land. Can we talk a little bit briefly about the next project that you have going on?
And
are you, where? So tell me the name of it, the full name?
The movie, well, right now it's called Sweetening the Pill.
Okay.
Whether we change the title or not, I'm not sure.
Okay. Because it's based on a book, correct?
It's not really based on a book at all.
Okay.
There was a book called Sweetening the Pill by Holly Griggs Ball, and Holly had sent my partner, Ricky Lake, and I the book.
Okay.
Several times because she had been trying to get a documentary off the ground at the time. So she sent us the book. I read her book and I was really intrigued by many things she brought up.
Yeah.
We essentially optioned the book, but like we pretty much just, you know, were inspired by her work. But it's I don't think the movie ultimately will have anything to do with Holly's book directly.
Okay. And so you're exploring female contraception more than but beyond the pill too, correct?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're really looking at hormonal birth control.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that hormonal birth control exists in this very, like, don't ask, don't tell world.
Yeah.
Where it's just like this dirty little secret where it's just like nobody really feels like they ever have any options. It's kind of like, well, you're on hormonal birth control or you're pregnant.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very hard thing for women and young girls, teenage girls or whatever, to talk about with their providers. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of pressure to get on these medications, mm-hmm. and they are medications.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of pressure to get on them for almost any reason. So it doesn't have to be for birth control.
Yeah.
It can be almost any problem with the menstrual cycle, endometriosis, PCOS, irregular periods, painful periods, acne. I mean, it's like anything, any female problem can be solved by, you know, the hormonal contraceptive. And I think that women are very disempowered when they speak up about the side effects because they are told that it's in their head, that it's not real, that the research doesn't support that, that they just need to switch to a different brand or a different pill.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, really non-hormonal options are not presented very often.
Yeah.
And if they are, I think there's a lot of stigma and around them as like, oh, God, you're doing that. You know, mm-hmm. oh, you're definitely going to get pregnant. So,
right.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, for a long time, at least in our culture, all the pressure is on women to take care of birth control.
That's interesting because it was used as an empowering tool in some ways, mm-hmm. in like the 50s and 60s. And then it's almost kind of getting used against women.
Yes. And it is an empowering tool. I think it still is an empowering tool. I mean, I think it's still it's very much like childbirth, you know.
Yeah.
So it's like if you know what you're getting into. Like if you have decided I'm having an elective cesarean or I'm having an epidural or whatever, you know, you're choosing an intervention and you know the risks and you've researched it and you've discussed it and this is your choice, that is very empowering. I think when it comes to birth control, women don't really know the risks.
Yeah.
They really don't.
Right.
You know, I think they're not really screened for potential issues. I don't think they understand the warning signs of when they could develop really serious health complications. And, you know, look, some of it is...
And long-term effects, too.
Oh, massive. I mean, we in the movie, we really look at, you know, things as sort of lighthearted as, you know, how hormonal birth control changes your pheromones. So it changes who you're attracted to sexually to...
That one's really fascinating.
Very fascinating, right? Did you read about that?
My wife told me about it at one point, saying that she read this at one point and decided that she wasn't going to, because, you know, in trying to find the right person for yourself, you could pick the person you think is right, and then you get off the pill and you're like,
And that happens all the time, apparently. Yeah. I was totally fascinated to read about that. And so I think that there's, you know, what happens a lot too is that what we see in the film is that women are put on the pill or the patch or the ring, whatever, you know, at such a young age these days. Mm-hmm. Again, mostly for something that is completely made up, which is called regulating your cycle. Just like nobody ever regulates their cycle with a pill, because when you're on the pill, you don't have a cycle.
Right.
You're not cycling. You're essentially in menopause. I mean, you're turned off your hormones.
Yeah.
So they don't really then understand that maybe if they develop like some depression or some mood issues, mm-hmm. then they end up seeking treatment for that and potentially getting put on an antidepressant, when nobody's really gone back to the root, which is that it may just be the birth control pill that's causing the depression. So we've covered a lot of stories about women who've had severe, severe depression, panic attacks.
I've even seen things related to sort of, I mean, when you get into the more kind of somato, you know, emotional mm-hmm. part of the body that the hormones are related to.
Yeah.
I've seen people with chronic pain issues that are actually related back to the pill, because
I've heard about that too.
And part of it is just because of the way that people don't realize we have like hundreds of hormones, you know, involved in all these, you know, communication relationships with you know, organ function and doing all sorts of different things. And when you disrupt one of those hormones, or when you change the response of something, mm-hmm. it sets off a whole series of responses. And, you know, for some people it might not come out as pain, or it might not come out as a mood thing or depression, but mm-hmm. everybody's going to have something that has some effect, some people stronger than others. And then there, you know, everybody has a trigger of some sort, either genetically or emotionally mm-hmm. or whatever, that can also set off the, you know, that whole spectrum.
Totally. Yeah. I just heard a pain story the other day where somebody was telling me that they had like really bad pain in their neck that was from, you know, had to do with taking synthetic hormones. And so, we probably won't have enough time in the movie to go into like every possible condition that can happen. But we do have a bunch of parents in the film who all lost their daughters to hormonal birth control, because they all suffered very sudden and unexpected pulmonary embolisms. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, they do talk about risk of stroke and risk of blood clots, which they call VTE, you know, venous thrombosis in the pill packet, but it's very small, the writing. And one of the things they sort of lead you to believe in the marketing is that you're only at risk for these kind of blood clots is if you're smoke or if you're obese, or, you know, which is really not the case at all, because the women in our film who died were all very young, very fit, very healthy, had no previous clotting disorders, had no other conditions. Mm. So their bereaved parents, we sort of follow them a little bit through this movie, trying to figure out how to, you know, really like get some more information out there, because they don't want this to happen to other girls.
Yeah.
So those stories are extremely upsetting, but I think they're also important to talk about. You know, yeah. Even though they're rare occurrences, you know, nothing's rare when it happens to you or your child.
Right.
So, you know, we talk about that. We talk about, I mean, we really also then look into this world of sort of femtech and looking at, you know, what might be more solutions for birth control that are more based in fertility awareness methods, and femtech and apps and different monitors and things they're coming out with, which I believe will probably be more of the future, I think, of birth control.
Do you cover anything about getting off birth control? Because that's another one of those things that I've seen that I've had, you know, and also just for anyone listening, I don't, you know, by having a conversation like this doesn't mean you should pull yourself today off of birth control, because I think there should also be a tapering when people are trying to get off these things, because we don't realize sometimes how powerful these hormones are.
It's very hard to transition off hormonal birth control. And so there are a couple people now actually doing online courses, and Holly Griggs-Ball, who wrote the book Sweetening the Pill, she's now preparing a course, because she's been doing workshops for women of how to transition off. Because what can happen a lot is that women try to go off these medications and they're terrified because they were using it to control acne or, you know, whatever. And so they are suddenly like, it's like you don't have a cycle for all these years, and then your body's like totally out of whack. And so you have these terrible periods, and you have all of a sudden all this crazy acne, and you know what I mean? So it's hard to go off them.
Yeah.
So a lot of times women just stay on them because they don't like what happens when they try to go off. But yeah, I think that's a really important piece of it too, for women who want to try other options. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's going to be like a very tough movie. I think we're going to get a lot of backlash.
But it's important that you're doing
this. I don't care, because I think it's important. And I think ultimately the messages that we show are, you know, to me, it all sort of goes back in some level to body literacy. Because I really do think that if, you know, like when girls are going through, let's say, sexual education in school, they're only learning about their menstrual cycle
just the facts.
As a way not to get pregnant, essentially.
Yeah.
They're not learning anything empowering about it.
Yeah.
They're not learning what, you know, their luteal phases, or, you know, their fertile phase, or what kind of, how that can affect their mood, or how can affect their energy, or how to like really, you know, be in touch with their cycles and how this can be a empowering thing. Like, they're not taught any of that.
Yeah.
They're literally just taught of like, this is when the egg comes and this is how you don't get pregnant. Yeah. And I think that if you don't have any connection, if you don't understand the names of things, of your own anatomy, if you can't ask questions about them, then it's very easy to walk into a clinic or walk into a doctor and someone says, oh, just take this pill every day and you'll never get pregnant. And you don't really understand, you know, what that's doing to your body, then it's much easier.
It's become this tool that makes things seemingly easy to manage, right?
Yes.
You don't have to live in a dynamic world as much with your body, but that's what we should be in. Like, we're trying to simplify life in some way by just like, you know, numbing down the experience of everything.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, I think these products should be available. I think they should be accessible. Yeah. I think women should have access to them. I think they should understand how they work. I think there's certain periods of people's lives where they may be willing to put up with certain side effects, you know, just to feel like, oh, this is one thing I don't have to worry about.
Absolutely.
You know, there's a place for them. So, but there's also, I think, a lot of things that people aren't thinking about when they start these products. They're not thinking about how long they're going to end up staying on them, and then what might happen, you know, at the end of the day to their fertility, to their sexuality. I mean, like, we've heard all these stories of women having like absolute testosterone crashes where they have no sex drive. They have, you know, their hair falls out. They have huge hormonal imbalances. Their hormones never go back online properly. So their fertility is affected. I mean, it's just like you don't know how each person's chemistry is going to react to like going on and off. I think it's a conversation that's very hard to have. It's very hard to have a conversation about health, wellness, and risk around birth control because it's just like, what do you mean? How can you even, you know, we're so lucky we have it. We're just so lucky we have it. Right. We just have to like shut up and take your pills and be so happy that, you know, you have this option. And it's like, no, you know, I think this is the age where women need to step up and
it's the age of information. We should have access to this kind of information at this point.
And options. And men should have options.
Yeah, absolutely. And you guys have been doing crowdfunding for it. Is that still going on?
We did a Kickstarter for like an initial raise. Okay. Yeah. And so we're in probably 75-80% finished in our post production.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it. Well, thanks. This was so great talking to you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And for people who are interested in learning anything more about Weed the People, do you have a site?
So everything's on weedthepeoplemovie.com.
Okay.
So yeah, you can go to weedthepeoplemovie.com and you can host a screening, you can pre-order the DVD. You can read all about the film. When is the podcast airing?
Probably be a couple weeks from now.
Perfect. Yeah. So I don't know what the exact date will be when people are listening to this, but I know January 22nd, it'll be available for sure on iTunes. But if you just go to weedthepeoplemovie.com, you can find out.
Okay. Awesome. Thanks so much, Abby.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Abby Epstein, folks. I love the work she and Ricky are doing in these projects. They're making films for social impact, storytelling, but also educating us on topics people should be covering and getting us emotionally involved in the right ways. Cannabis is a tricky topic. Its Schedule I status federally and legalization from state to state make it hard to come to terms with its right place in our culture. And the fact that research is limited by federal patent makes it nearly impossible to have an evidence-based discussion on its most beneficial and safe use. What I think this film did brilliantly, though, is push against the discomfort and, you know, force us into a broader conversation. And I hope that my conversation here with Abby on the podcast opened it up a little bit further. If you have any experiences to share related to this topic, not necessarily your high school and college experiences with cannabis, unless they are really compelling or funny, please share them with me at jeremy@highwaytohealthpodcast.com. Also, I'm sure there are a number of you in health fields, research fields, or involved in the business of cannabis. I'd love to hear from you and your take on this topic and conversation. And don't forget to check out Weed the People, coming out January 22nd. Also, last reminder here, we are still taking submissions for our contest here on Highway Health. We'd like to hear about the work you are doing to improve the lives and improve our collective experience. I'll be picking one of your passion projects and have you here as a guest on Highway to Health to share your story and your mission. Email me at the same place, jeremy@highwaytohealthpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet. Be well, my friends.